Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us in studio today is Professor Rudo Mativa, the head of the intensive care unit at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. Professor Mativa is also currently an adjunct professor in critical care medicine and a pediatric intensivist at the University of Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, South Africa. On the academic front, she graduated from the University of Natal, South Africa, completed a pediatric residency at Chris Hani Baragwanath Academic Hospital, and a fellowship in pediatric critical care at Duke University, North Carolina, USA. To add to her achievements, she was the recipient of the Presidential Award of Critical Care Society in the Southern African region. And I've just learnt that this year she celebrates her 29th anniversary at the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, it's the largest hospital in the Southern Hemisphere and one of the largest hospitals in the world. I believe it has more than 3,000 beds, serving the community of Soweto, which has an official population statistic of approximately 1.3 million people. It's also a referral hospital for other areas in South Africa and a teaching hospital for the University of the Witwatersrand Medical School. Can you please tell us more about the work you do as head of the intensive care unit?
Right. So I started being the head of the intensive care unit at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital in 1998. And as the head of the intensive care unit, I have to draft policy on admission criteria and exclusion criteria. I have to liaise with referring clinical departments to see how we can best serve them in looking after their critically ill patients. On the academic and training side, I actually run a fellowship program for both adult and pediatric intensive care specialists. So I train them to become intensivists. And I also train registrars that are rotating through our unit that need that exposure before they can qualify in their specialty. In addition to that, I participate in a program of training critical care nurses.
And they play a tremendous role servicing and helping patients to restore their health.
Yes, so you could never run an intensive care unit without nurses, because they are the people that are at the patient bedside 24 hours a day, that are monitoring the patient and that will alert you if there are changes in the patient's condition. And they are also the people that are often there and communicate with families and relatives.
And that's often a serious issue to navigate. It's not just about maintaining the patient's healthcare, but also addressing those social issues and the social concerns with relatives.
That's right. So an intensive care unit is what we call a multidisciplinary clinical environment. So you would have medical staff, you would have nursing staff, you have social workers, you have physiotherapists, you have speech and occupational therapy, microbiologists, nutritionists. Sometimes we call the clergy in.
That's very diverse. Can you share some of the statistics on the hospital and the ICU unit in particular?
I think to actually appreciate what the ICU deals with, I will start with the statistics of the hospital. So Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital has 3,000, sometimes 3,200 inpatient beds. In any given year, we will see over 1 million patients in our outpatients department.
A million. That is a phenomenal figure.
Yes. So it's a very busy place. We will perform about 70,000 theater operations a year. The hospital will have close to 35,000 deliveries of newborn babies per year. On a daily basis, the hospital serves 12,000 meals. The hospital has just over 750 medical doctors, and the nursing component at the moment stands at 2,805 nurses, and that is not sufficient for the hospital. So that's the big hospital. Now, Normally, the recommendation is for you to have an ICU. The number of beds in that ICU should be between 8 to 12% of your inpatient bed numbers. However, at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, the main ICU that services most of the hospital only has 36 beds. When I did the math,
0.1%.
It's not even 1%. The minimum number of critical care beds we should have is about 250. So we have 36 beds. Now already one can appreciate that the pressures on those beds is going to be immense, and that one has to have very strict admission and exclusion criteria. Ideally, one would love to offer everybody intensive care, but you actually have to rationalize the resources and use them in a justifiable, responsible manner.
It sounds as though you're under incredible pressure operating in that environment. And to add to that, you hold the highest position in the ICU, where everybody expects you to make the right decision at all times. And whilst you make every effort to succeed, the challenge is competing as equals in a world where most high positions are still held by men. To a certain extent, you're still judged by others on your gender. What is your intake on this? And is there a fine line between how men and women are judged in your profession?
Oh, definitely. It's still very much a men's world. And I am the first African woman to become an intensive care specialist in South Africa and to actually head a unit. And when I first started as the head of the ICU, I was being second-guessed at every turn, getting comments being passed that, this unit is going to collapse because now it's being run by a female and on top of that a black woman. And people kind of try and impose their way of thinking onto you, and they really don't respect your level of training and your level of expertise. To be honest, in the beginning, I had to be a really rough person and try to make my point so many times more so people could actually take me seriously.
And did you find that that was how you overcame those challenges?
That and some advice from my parents was how I managed to overcome those challenges. But I think over time, as the people started appreciating your expertise and the fact that they didn't know anything about your field, they start taking a back seat. But for the first 6 years, I had a rough time.
That's incredibly challenging because you were there from 1998, so we're going into your 17th year as head of the department.
Yeah, so I eventually had to just put my foot down. I remember one time as head of a unit, on the university side, there is a fund where we put our research money in. And when I just took over as the head of the unit, some male colleagues said I wouldn't be able to manage finances because I'm a woman.
So blatantly gender discrimination.
Yes, blatantly like that. So my department's account was handed over to the head of anesthesia, who happened to be a man, to administer it.
That's so disempowering.
I felt insulted, and I became what we call a strat Macy, you know, a street girl. I totally threw my toys around. But also, as a way to prove to them that I was capable, I went and studied for a diploma in business management, and I got it.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So, you know, you have to go not 1 mile further, maybe 20 miles further than your male counterpart.
But that seems to be the trend. You have to do more than just your job. You have to do, and as you've rightly said now, securing backup, securing credentials from another institution to say, I have the capacity, I have the capability, and here is a piece of paper, a certificate that proves my capability.
Yes, unfortunately, at my level, it's still like that. And I'm hoping in the future, with the younger generations coming up, it will be a little bit easier because people like me should actually serve to iron out those difficult places in the journey. We need to iron out those obstacles so that people that come after us are able to have a smooth journey.
You mentioned briefly in the conversation that we had that your dad played an instrumental role in terms of supporting you, and I'd just like to share with listeners that you grew up under apartheid South Africa. You were one of seven children born to Professor Mativa and Mrs. Gladys Mativa. Can you take us through some of those moments when you were growing up in those days when you knew that studying medicine was your destiny in life?
Okay, when I was born, which is many, many years ago, my father was a high school teacher and my mother was a stay-at-home mom. And my father was still studying long distance with UNISA to do his university degrees. And when he eventually finished, he then was appointed a lecturer at the University of the North, and today it's called University of Limpopo. And when my mother had her last child, the seventh child, when my sister was 6 months old, my mother went back to school to do her teacher's diploma. So I am fortunate in the sense that I grew up in a family where education was being promoted. I saw my parents work hard night through night through night, you know, and still look after us. So me and my siblings were very much aware of what education, you know, could do for you and open doors for you. So we all went to university. We have four doctors in our family, one lawyer and two lecturers.
That's an amazing achievement.
But it was hard work. And we were not rich, or things didn't come easy. But what my parents taught us was you work hard, consistently. It doesn't matter that we are in a segregated community. You can do and be whatever you want to be. When did I decide to be a medical doctor? I accompanied my father to his general practitioner when I was 8 years old, and he was given an injection of penicillin that he had an allergic reaction to. And I watched helplessly as the doctor resuscitated my father. And at that young age, I decided I don't ever want to feel so helpless when somebody I love dearly is sick. And that's where the idea was planted. And when my brother, who's 2 years older than me, was admitted to the medical school, I then saw, well, there's not that much to it. I just need to study hard, get the marks that are required. There is a school that will accept us, and that was the University of Natal, which was the only medical school that was training black doctors at the time. A very strong medical school at the time. We had dedicated, highly experienced teachers. And we've had a lot of good products come out of there. Our current Minister of Health, Minister Motsoaledi, is a graduate of my medical school. The former Premier of KwaZulu-Natal, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, is a graduate of the University of Natal. I am a proud graduate of the University of Natal. My brother, who also holds a Master's in Public Health from Harvard University, is a graduate of the University of Natal. My younger sister, who was a cardiologist, but she's passed on now, the first black female cardiologist in South Africa, was a graduate of the University of Natal. So I'm really very proud to have been a product of that medical school.
Sounds like it's produced fantastic alumni.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, this is Lyra, South African Afro Soul singer and songwriter. You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy.
You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31 meter band. Today we're talking to Professor Mativa, head of ICU at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital in South Africa, the largest hospital in the Southern Hemisphere. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. In our previous segment, we were talking briefly about the amazing statistics with Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, having over 1 million outpatients a year, going through 70,000 operations, 30,000 babies being delivered, and serving 12,000 meals a day, as well as touching on Professor Mativa's history and how she came to enter into the medical field and her tenure at the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. One of the elements that you're involved with is the AstraZeneca Africa Outreach Program on improving critical care structures and continuing professional development, which I understand has extended into Ethiopia, Kenya, and Nigeria. Can you tell us a bit more about the program?
Yes, this is something that I'm very passionate about, and I was fortunate to have AstraZeneca as a partner company to pursue this initiative. My passion is to develop critical care throughout Southern Africa so that countries can have this resource available to their citizens. So at the moment, I am expecting a pediatrician from Ghana to join me at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital for a period of 2 years, where I'll be training him to become an intensive care specialist.
That's quite a long term, 2 years.
It is a long term, but in my opinion, it's actually very short because this subspecialty is very broad. But we have to have a defined period of training.
Sure.
Where we can say the person is conversant with the basic principles of intensive care medicine.
And once he's done his training, does he then go back to Ghana?
He goes back to Ghana. He will be certified as an intensivist with the Health Professions Council of South Africa. And he goes back to Ghana, and he's then able to train others.
So it's a very sustainable initiative.
It is very sustainable.
To give back to others. So you consolidate, you attain your training, you have a qualification that's certified in South Africa, that's recognized in Ghana, and then you're able to facilitate training of other people.
Exactly.
In our discussion that we had offline, state hospitals are exceptionally resource-starved, whether it is from infrastructure through to human capital deficits, and you've mentioned that in terms of the number of hospital beds, you've only got 36, and you should be actually having approximately 200. Two of your areas of interest include providing critical care in resource-scarce environments and exploring the possibilities of telemedicine in Africa for critical care. They seem to be incredibly important, but also really interesting developments. Can you please tell us a bit about those developments?
If I can start with telemedicine.
Yes.
And telemedicine is a system through which you can use technology to be able to visualize a patient who could be thousands of kilometers away from you on a video screen, and also to have data about that patient beamed to you on a video screen. And be able to offer an opinion of what you think is wrong with the patient and an opinion on what treatment strategies can be pursued. So I could be sitting in Johannesburg in a room with a computer and a video camera and a screen and be looking at a patient, let's say in Lagos, in an intensive care unit. And I would be the intensive care specialist. So what that would help is even if we have few intensive care specialists, they could have a presence in a very wide geographical area using telemedicine.
In theory, they could be located anywhere in the world as long as there is the connectivity between them and the patient.
That's right. In fact, in the USA, they have a system where remote hospitals with intensive care units are run by intensivists in a call center kind of setup via telemedicine. So it's a very promising strategy that could be adopted by African countries, just as we're starting, because we will not reach our human capital very quickly. But at the moment, I have to provide intensive care medicine in a very resource-scarce environment. Now, this is where one battles or grapples with ethical principles. And many people may not understand, and they may read you as a very hard-hearted person, but you're not. And in this situation, I try to balance the interests of a community or a society against those of an individual. So the ethical principle that I normally employ is called distributive justice. And distributive justice is you will use the little that you have to benefit as many people as possible rather than pouring that little into one person.
It must still be very hard to do.
It is very hard. And an example that I give is if I had a 38-year-old father who is a breadwinner involved in a car accident, and it looked as though he could benefit from intensive care intervention, coming in at the same time as a 93-year-old statesman who is well-loved and highly revered, but who is old and is dying because of age or a terminal disease. If I was faced with those two, I would take the father who was in a car accident. And this is where you would actually be at odds with a lot of people, because they would feel, save the 93-year-old elderly person. But you are choosing the 38-year-old father who's got fractured bones and a head injury. But you think you can help him and return him to a normal functioning state, and he would still be a breadwinner for his family and a contributing member of society. The 93-year-old has had his good innings. He has contributed to the country, and it's time to let him go.
So you have to take an exceptionally objective approach when you are confronted with situations like that.
Yes, I do. And it's sometimes it's not clear-cut, and it's fraught with conflict.
Definitely.
Yeah. So you have to, over time, develop a thick skin but still remain human and sensitive inside. You know, it's a very delicate balance to strike.
And I think that also speaks to leadership capability and capacity on making those important calls. And I think that building female leadership capacity is important for the future of our country and also for the women in our country. As a professor who currently heads up the ICU department at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, how do you see female leadership in South Africa? And do you have time to become involved in the political arena?
My political aspirations would be to be in a position where I can formulate policy that would benefit people, especially in the health system. So I wouldn't want to be like a minister, or, well, I guess a minister formulates policy, but I would want a very hands-on approach and be able to implement whatever policies are being formulated and evaluate whether they are working. I don't think I have aspirations on the presidential chair.
It's a very hot seat.
It is a very hot seat, yes. So I would like to be in a position where I can formulate policy for our healthcare structures, and also matching resources to what services we can provide to people, and not just promising everybody heaven and earth when we can't deliver on that. Because there comes a time when you have to tell people that we can only fund your health care up to this. You know, the basic requirements of health, yes, that is a right that we must fund. Okay, but there are certain really highly specialized technical health interventions that maybe South Africa or a developing country may not be able to afford. And we need to come clean with our citizens and say, this we cannot do, or this we can do, but these are the criteria that will be employed to actually select the patients that will access that service. So that is already difficult, because now you're going to be leaving people out. But I think if handled in a sensitive manner, we could actually get our citizens to back that kind of policy and be with us. At the moment, if you've got money in South Africa, you can get anything, even when you don't need it. Okay, you can stay in an intensive care unit bed until you die, when you could be dying at home in a dignified manner. In the public sector, we cannot afford that.
Well, it's incredibly challenging, but I understand we have scarce resources, and it's about being able to utilize them maximally, well, to benefit rather than just the individual, but to benefit a greater portion of society. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chakachaka, and I'm UNICEF and Rollback Malaria Goodwill Ambassador. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in the struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy. A program against social ills such as racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka every week on this day at this time.
Today we're talking to Professor Mativa, the head of the ICU at Krishani Baragwanath Hospital. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. In our previous segment, we were talking about Professor Mativa's role and her passion for critical care to be able to support and provide those services throughout Southern Africa and the incredibly challenging aspects of distributive justice. Prof. Mativa, turning now towards the academic side and the development side of building, nurturing talent for our pipeline development, do you think that medical schools in South Africa are doing enough to encourage women to pursue careers in medicine?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that there is now a higher intake of female students into the medical schools. When I went to medical school, I think only 10% of my class was female. But now it's not that difficult to find a class that has got 60% females and 40% males in medical school.
So the ratio has shifted totally the other way.
It has shifted. And I think it's also with the South African government's way of empowering women and women actually coming to realize that they can go out there and do or participate in professions that were previously maybe reserved for men. And we know that we are capable, and we're educating our daughters now. They're not just staying at home and waiting to be married. We're educating our daughters. They're getting into university. They're getting to medical school in great numbers. They are graduating from medical school. The gap then comes after they've finished their junior degree in medicine. And I think we are not doing enough to entice those female doctors to come and specialize and be specialists. And I feel this is a place where I can play a role as a mentor to female doctors. And to that effect, in my department, I have encouraged a lot of females to come and specialize in intensive care medicine. And in fact, since starting to run the critical care fellowship program at Krishani Baragwanath Hospital, I have produced 23 intensive care specialists, and 60% of those were female.
That's a very rewarding experience.
Yeah, I don't mean to brag, but I'm very proud of that achievement. And I'm still encouraging women to come in. And I guess I have looked at how I have balanced my life, you know, my normal life with my working life. And I have seen that it's doable. You know, you can be both a mother, a wife, and a professional. And in fact, these days, working hours can be flexible and you can still contribute towards healing the nation, but still be a mother at home. I have a son who is turning 27 now. He is married. He has a son who will turn 2 in October, and I enjoy being a grandmother.
And has he followed in the family business?
No, my son went to the United States with me when I was doing my fellowship, where I was working every second night. And at the age of 8, coincidentally, too, decided he was never going to do medicine.
So where you were at age of 8 committing your life and determining that that was going to be your future path, he at the age of 8 declared...
Decided, nope, so he's gone commercial. He did a bachelor in commerce at the University of Johannesburg. He is working in a bank now.
It's very interesting in terms of how children change, either following in the paths and the roots of their parents or going in a completely contrasting direction.
That's right.
Two of the elements that you raised, which I thought were very interesting, was the first point you spoke about mentoring. And I think that for women, we've moved away from the element of role models because the role models have already been established. But now we're moving to the phase of mentorship to actually shift that dynamic of saying, I've provided the example, but now I'm going to help you empower yourself. And the second element that you spoke about was the importance of being able to balance, because often people think you can't have it all. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about how you can have it all, having that family, having your work career, and succeeding in both sides of the world.
Okay, as a woman, or as women, we are actually fortunate creatures because we have a very wide network of relationships. We may also belong to extended families. So if you're a mother, your children are not necessarily left to their own devices when you are at work. Your mother, your sister, or your aunt could be guiding the children. When you come off from work, you actually put in time with your children and experience some quality time and interact with them. It takes longer hours, so there is not much downtime for you, but you know, you will reap the rewards with time. I am very close to my son. I was working long hours, but whenever I was with him, I was totally focused on him and building the relationship between me and him and making sure that he was getting what he needed to pursue his educational interests. So, you know, people will say, okay, you can't actually get the balance right. Sometimes, yes, you might miss out on certain things, missing that first step of, you know, of your child when your child starts walking, or missing the first time they don't walk with support, miss the first time they say a word, but you can catch up.
You get the second time
you
or
get
the third
second time.
Yes.
Which
are equal, it would still be the first time for you.
Exactly.
Now, Prof. Mativa, some of the guests that we've had on the show, such as yourself, have reached tremendous achievements in their lifetimes. And they talk about various factors that have contributed to their success, whether it is hard work or perseverance. What, in your opinion, have been the key drivers to your success?
Okay, I think naturally I'm a driven person. Like I told you, I'm a middle child. I'm a go-getter. I want to be where the action is. But the people that really shaped me were my mother and father. Firstly, by observing them working very hard and consistently, and them reaching, you know, their heights, and then them telling me that I was capable of doing that. It's very important to inculcate that in our children when they are young, that the sky will only be limited by your imagination and your effort. You know, if you don't limit it, you can go where no other person has been before. So my father and my mother were very instrumental in teaching me how to work hard, to work consistently, and that there was never an age where you could say, I'm through with learning. An example, my mother has 7 children and then goes back to school. An example, my father is putting 7 children through school plus 5 other children of his brothers who had passed away, putting them through school but studying towards his PhD and his doctorate.
That is so admirable, how he managed to find the time, how he managed to find the resources. That just speaks of motivation and dedication.
He was a very motivated person, but he made us part of his studies. He was a professor of linguistics, and when it came to recording sounds, he used us to make the different sounds. So we felt an integral part of his studies, and we never missed out on Dad not being there. So this is where I say you can have it all. You can involve your children in parts of your work. You're filing documents. Let them do the puncturing. Let them do the putting in the plastic sheets and filing. You know, you're spending time with them. They're learning about your work. Okay, and they're seeing, okay, Mom is 55. She's still studying. You know, so education never stops.
It became part of life.
It became part of life for me. And as we're speaking, I'm registered for a postgraduate diploma in health sciences education. And this year will be my final year. And my colleagues often tease me and say, there isn't a year where I'm not studying for something. But it keeps me abreast with issues. And I think it keeps me young. And I really enjoy it. You know, so my philosophy of having it all was created all the way back in childhood.
Just remarkable, all of those achievements. Prof. Mateeba, we are now running out of time. In closing our discussion today, along the years, experience comes with wisdom. As someone who has worked incredibly hard throughout her life and reached success, from your experience, what would be your advice to all the women and mothers who want their daughters to follow in their footsteps? Well, actually, to follow in your footsteps.
Okay. The first thing is believe in yourself. Number two, it doesn't matter how humble your origins are. You can touch the sky. You have it in you. Every single girl child has it in them to be a great person. We raise other human beings. We give birth to other human beings. We run families. We are custodians of cultural practices and, you know, life skills. So science should be a piece of cake. So what I would say to women out there is, do not look at your color. Do not look at your social status. What is of importance is your brain and your ability to multitask and to see opportunities where others do not see them. We are capable beings and nothing is off limits. Okay, physically we may not be endowed to go and work in the mines, but we could run a mine as a manager. You know, so we mustn't restrict our choices just because we're female or we're black or we're previously disadvantaged. I mean, I started my primary schooling in a farm school, okay? And I'm a professor of critical care medicine today. So if I can do it, everybody can do it. And in mentoring people, I would share. I'm happy to share how I dealt with day-to-day life, you know, to overcome potential obstacles. So I'm a strong believer in women. In men too. I mean, I'm not saying I don't believe in men, but I think women need to come to the fore. They are pillars of society. They must be pillars of education, pillars of leadership. And we could have a better world because of that.
Prof. Mateeba, thank you so much for sharing those words of inspiration. It's been such a pleasure to have you on our show today. And we wish you the best of luck in the pursuit of the next program, and we would love to hear more about the future developments, whether they be on the continent or within the South African space itself.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance. And today we have been talking to Professor Mateeba, the head of the intensive care unit at Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital, the largest hospital in the Southern Hemisphere. Tune into the show next week when we talk to Professor Lundgren, the academic head of the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Witwatersrand and clinical head of anesthesiology at Chris Hani Baragwanath Academic Hospital.